From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. You may not think that the Secretary of Agriculture has anything to do with you, but everything related to food in this country, down to the cost of vegetables at the supermarket and the price of a steak dinner at your favorite restaurant, falls under the purview of the Ag Secretary. Trump chose former Governor of Georgia Sonny Perdue for this role, and Congress approved the nomination. We called Harvest Public Media's investigations editor, Peggy Lowe, to find out how Sonny's settling in. Hi, Peggy.
Hi, Evan. Thanks so much for having me on your show.
I have to say the timing couldn't be more perfect. Everybody is talking about what's going on over there at the USDA.
That's right. The budget cuts that have been in the news this week, obviously, are affecting the USDA a great deal. Sonny Perdue, the new USDA secretary, is ready to carry out a new agenda under the Trump administration that will really profoundly change the USDA, certainly, and potentially rural America.
Let's try and unpack what it is he's doing. How is he going to rearrange the USDA in a way that isn't just administrative, that actually affects farmers?
Well, number one, he's reorganizing the department. So, for instance, one of his lieutenants used to be a rural development guy. He has taken that position away and put that as trade. And so a lot of people are saying that's a sign that he's going to make what was what's called a mission area much less of a priority. And that's things like helping small town businesses, stuff like that. Sonny Perdue is also promising big cuts, no pun intended here, to sacred cows like food stamps, crop insurance, subsidies for farmers, school nutrition programs. And significantly, too, I think, Evan, he's undoing much of what his predecessors did and much of what the agriculture industry and farmers have wanted in the past.
Yeah, that's what's so interesting about this is it isn't like farmers who voted for Trump purportedly in large numbers are embracing what's on the table now at USDA.
Absolutely not. In fact, they're furious. And there's been a lot of stories this weekend, and all the folks that we talked to have said they feel betrayed. They feel that the Trump administration has turned its back on the very people who voted him into office.
So talk a little bit about that divide, maybe in the form of talking about the Farmer Fair Practices rules.
Okay, this is a really good example, Evan, of things that are coming undone. So this Farmer Fair Practices rules, this was something aimed at kind of trying to help a smaller independent meat producer, like, say, a chicken farmer who is indebted to the poultry company and is raising chickens or turkeys for these big companies. It took years for the two sides to agree on changes to this, and the other side being, of course, the larger meat companies and larger producers. Just at the end of the Obama administration, they had finally come into some sort of compromise, and it was to go into effect. But the Trump administration came in, they put that on hold, they put it open for comment. That means it will be, like, say, redesigned. And so it's not a good sign that that will ever go into effect and try to protect the smaller, more independent meat growers.
Give us an actual example of how the Farmer Fair Practice rules would have helped a small chicken farmer.
Well, for instance, there's this thing called vertical integration, which we talk a lot about in agriculture. So say you're a chicken farmer and you are indebted to Tyson. And so Tyson decides every single thing that happens basically on your farm. And they own everything. They own the feed that you will feed the animals. They own the animals from little baby chickens up until their full growth, until when they're harvested. And then they even, like, own buildings on your land. A lot of people, liberals, I guess, would say that this has really created servants out of a lot of the farmers on their own land. Some of the protections in this bill would create some opportunities for them to have more decision-making and not allow these big companies to have all that power.
So sad. And this year, in fact, is supposed to be a very dramatic year in a bad way for farmers.
Absolutely. I mean, already farmers are talking about that this is a farm crisis and that that's rivaling the really terrible one they had back in the 80s. Land prices are dropping. Crop prices are very low because, of course, once again, it was about overproduction. There's just a lot of corn and soybeans still out there. And so they're saying at the very time they will really need this kind of help in the form of, say, farm subsidies, say, food stamps, say, rural development dollars on Main Street. This is exactly the time it appears that the Trump administration is ready to back out of all those kinds of programs.
Also, trade, of course, comes into this. You mentioned it early in our conversation. What are you hearing from farmers about Sunny's proposals to roll back NAFTA and the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
Well, you know, this was a big promise from the Trump administration, or the Trump candidate, I should say, while out on the campaign trail. Farmers, despite what he said, you know, still voted for him in large measure. So Trump has come in and he has said he wants to completely renegotiate NAFTA. They're very, very angry about that. And he has already thrown out the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That was just agreed on after like a decade. And this was a massive trade deal among 12 countries, including the U.S., and basically opening up all those markets along the Pacific Rim to producers here in the U.S. So all the farmers are very furious about this. NAFTA has been really, really good to farmers. It opened up markets for corn, pork, soybeans, wheat. Just last year alone, get this number, the U.S. exported nearly $39 billion worth of agricultural goods to Canada and Mexico. So this is, once again, you know, farmers are feeling betrayed and they feel like the Trump administration doesn't have their best interests in mind.
So now they're going to be sitting on all of these huge surpluses that they can't sell, and they're going to get the short end of the stick from consumers who are now being more and more educated about food waste.
Well, that's true. I don't know what else to. I don't know what else to say to you about that, Ellen.
It's just like being between a rock and a hard place, which they are anyway all the time. I understand that you asked him about climate change, and here's what he told you.
I've been on a farm since the early 50s, and I can tell you the climate is changing, but the fact of what are the cause of it is really what is in dispute. And some of the things we've done from man-made causes, I think, are very unproductive. So the science, we don't know definitively, in my opinion, what is causing climate change. Many people feel like, from a scientific basis, that it's settled. I don't agree with that.
Welcome to interviewing someone from the Trump administration. You know, I felt like it was very important, first of all, just to even get on record if he believes in climate change or not. Because, of course, Trump has said he doesn't believe in global warming. So we did get that on the record. That said, then he goes into this odd explanation of, well, the science isn't definitive yet. Well, yeah, it really is. Most scientists believe, you know, that it's man-made emissions that have created the global warming problem. So it's a very interesting time to be interviewing the Trump administration officials.
Yeah, and most people agree that agriculture is one of the largest drivers of climate change.
Absolutely. And so he didn't want to say anything probably, you know, that would negatively affect farmers and or negatively affect, you know, their votes. They like that the Trump administration has been anti-climate change.
Okay, now immigration, the other elephant in the room. What is Sunny's current stance on it?
Well, this was really fascinating. So I interviewed Sonny Perdue on the fourth day of his ag secretariness. He had just been sworn in by Clarence Thomas in Washington, and he quickly came out to Kansas City because he was going all over the Midwest. I got 20 minutes with the guy. So I was hitting on all the hot topics. And I said, so about immigration, you know, when you were governor in Georgia, you had a very big crackdown on illegal immigration. What that did then, though, was farmers, a lot of them went bankrupt because food was rotting in the fields. There were no workers there to do all this work because for fear of deportation or because they were deported, they were gone. So I asked him about this, and all of a sudden, he drops this, I think, pretty major news and pretty much a major reversal of Trump administration policy, which Trump had said he's going to deport everyone who's undocumented, some 11 million people. Well, Sonny Perdue said, no. I sat down with President Trump at a roundtable with farmers this week, and President Trump understands that farmers and agriculture needs all these workers. So we're going to come up with a plan. And I don't know if you want to play this tape, Evan.
He understands that they are long-term immigrants, sometimes undocumented immigrant laborers out here on the farms, many of them that are doing a great job contributing to the economy of the United States. That is not his focus, nor will that be my focus. In fact, I've hired a lady to come to work, a labor lawyer who had been at Farm Bureau, to help us design a program. I'm hoping we can provide the president and his administration a blueprint and a program of how we can separate and divide and understand who are the immigrants that are contributing to the American society, but he has no desire to remove people who are contributing to the economic society here, nor do I.
I was astonished, and I just said, well, that sounds like a pathway to citizenship, and boom, he came right back at me and said, no, those aren't my words. But essentially, that does sound kind of like what he wants. Perhaps not full citizenship, but some sort of legal status that these undocumented workers can stay in the U.S. And that's a major reversal, I think.
Well, California Senators Dianne Feinstein and Kamala Harris apparently are bringing forth a bill to create a blue card.
Right. So this is interesting, like sort of instead of the green card, they're calling it a blue card. And it would create some sort of legality, you know, like that qualifying workers could become eligible to adjust to a green card or some sort of legal permanent residency in time. Already, though, farmers are criticizing it because they say that Senators Feinstein and Harris are missing the point, that what they really need is a visa program that would allow several hundred thousand new legal immigrants to be brought into the U.S. to do this work, because that's how many people they need.
So rather than legalizing people who are already here doing the work, they want those people to be subject to deportation, and they would rather reach out and bring in new people?
I don't think that they want the people who are here to be deported. No, I don't believe that. In fact, they want these folks who have been here for years and who have worked these jobs to stay here. And they want their families to stay here. But because of a lot of the threats that the Trump administration has thrown out, you know, a lot of the families are fearful of being deported. They want folks to stay here. But they also need to bring in many, many more, because this work isn't really done by Americans.
And meanwhile, people are streaming out of the country.
That's right.
Okay, so now let's, instead of saying the word farm, let's use the word food. President Trump's proposed budget cuts affect food policy in a huge way. In the new farm bill, he is proposing to cut SNAP or food stamps by 25%. And to reduce farm subsidies, which is ironic because a lot of farmers and people who work for farmers rely on food stamps. He's also trying to roll back Michelle Obama's school lunch program.
And this is where you really have to look at motives. You know, I mean, you have to stop and think, why don't you want our kids to have good food at school? What is wrong with you?
So I'm curious about what you think the response to these dramatic changes will be. Do you think with this new activism that we're seeing on many fronts from the center left and progressive side, that food issues have a shot to move center stage in a national discussion?
I think it's a really interesting time for agriculture. I think a few things could happen. I think one of the negative things that could happen is that these interests could become more splintered by those opposing these big draconian cuts. Like, say, for instance, there could be, say, a coalition of, you know, liberals and maybe the conservatives who are against these draconian cuts. For instance, Senator Pat Roberts of Kansas has come out, and he's very angry about the stuff that Trump has proposed. And he's the head of the Senate Ag Committee, so we'll see about that. And then there's like this conservative versus really conservative. For instance, the Heritage Foundation hates farm subsidies. So there'll be a really interesting conflict there. Now, does that leave an opening for progressives? Perhaps, and to a certain extent, it could leave an opening for them, and they could help moderate some changes, especially if they continue to get consumers aboard. Like you mentioned earlier, Evan, you know, more and more people are really becoming educated about what they're eating. So when consumers say they want GMO-free or humane treatment of animals or pesticide-free food, that's when companies will really, you know, start listening. But other than that, as far as the politics of food and the politics of virtually anything right now, your guess is as good as mine.
Wow. Well, I look forward to more of these discussions. I hope they get more positive.
I do too. And in the meantime, I'll have a lot to cover.
Thank you, Peggy.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure to talk to you again.
That's Harvest Public Media's investigations editor, Peggy Lowe. You can find a link to her reporting from Farm Country. It is excellent. On our website, go to blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. Next, when the show continues, we talk to the world's most famous butcher. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman.
Finalmente la carne vera. E il primo morso è stato il paradiso. Era il paradiso.
The last time we spoke with Dario Cecchini, he shared the story of abandoning his dream of becoming a veterinarian to run the family butcher shop in Ponzano instead. Cecchini's back in L.A. with his wife and translator, Kim Wicks, to discuss his respect for the whole animal and what's on the horizon at his Antica Macelleria Cecchini. Hi, Dario.
Ciao.
Che bello di averti qua, no?
Ma guarda.
Your new concept is scheduled to open next year.
Io nasco macellaio.
So I was born a butcher. My family have been doing this work for 250 years. Myself, for the last 42 years. I was born and raised 10 meters from the butcher shop. This job has always been a part of my life. I started following my father around when I was 3 years old. And so I always saw my family had respect for the animal and took responsibility for this act of killing. This idea that we are carnivores, and so we must have an ethic related to using every part well. All my life, I've sought the best and the most simple solution for each cut of beef or pork. I've always tried to explain that this idea that the fillet is the best cut on the animal is an extravagant thought. And if we're going to kill an animal just for a fillet, what sense is there in that? I took the cooking that I learned from my grandmother, the cooking I grew up with, and I used it and developed it. When you are born in a little village like my town of Ponzano in the heart of Tuscany, I was born into a family where we made ends meet, but there wasn't extra money. And in a butcher's family like that, you don't grow up eating bistecche, the steaks. You grow up eating all of the cuts that others aren't interested in buying. So I grew up eating tripe and trotters and muzzle and tail. When I was growing up, I thought a cow must have maybe 10 heads and 40 feet because that's what I was eating. My grandmother was a beautiful woman. She had the most amazing hands and heart that she put into her cooking. Me and my sister Marina, we grew up eating the most incredible dishes. I saw the steaks. I saw my father cut the steaks. I saw my mother wrap the steaks. And I saw our clients carry the steaks out of the store. It was a dream of mine to have a steak, but it never arrived until my 18th birthday, when by then I'd lost all hope. My father gave me a steak for my birthday. He said, my firstborn son, who will carry forward the butcher shop for me, has the right to a steak. I was so excited. It was my first time. I remember the scent of this steak cooking, and I can still see my grandmother leaning over the hearth, grilling the steak for me. Meat, just for me. And that first bite, it was paradise. Heaven, and the second, the third, heaven, pure heaven. But then I kind of woke up and I said, all my life I've been waiting for a steak. It's delicious, but so has all of the foods that my grandmother has cooked for us up to now. I've been marvelous, wonderful. And so this became my mission in life. Can a person in a small village, in a small shop, sow the seeds of this idea that we can eat more ethically? Treat the animal with respect by using every part well, from the nose to the tail, and remember always to give thanks. This has been my mission.
You were recently in Brazil, and I understand that you found some inspiration there.
I've always been inspired by other countries. In the world, I find that there is the cooking of the stars, the ones that get stars for their restaurants, and the cooking of the stalls, of the simple folk. And I've always been particularly inspired by the cooking of the common folk, because that's what I grew up with, because I believe that there can be good food at a good price. We can feed more people if we're feeding them good food and food that we can all afford. Because if we use every part of the animal well, then meat can be well-priced and affordable. And I find that in Brazil, they are particularly good at using the four quarters of the animals. And that is the inspiration that I have taken for my new project.
So I've heard that it's going to be a paninoteca, which is a sandwich shop. Since it's coming from you, I expect that it will be unlike any other paninoteca.
Cecchini panini. Pane buono.
Cecchini panini is going to be good meat that we cut. It's going to be using the forequarter in particular. I'm going to keep my grandmother as my inspiration as well and make these four-quarter cuts that are often ignored into something absolutely marvelous.
Why is this part of the animal ignored?
100 years ago, Pellegrino Artusi was the person who was writing what we consider today the Bible of Italian cuisine. He numbered his recipes, and recipe number one was broth. 100 years ago, it was broth, beef broth, that was considered the highest form of cooking you could get from meat. In fact, it was so nutritious that it was considered nearly a medicine to give to people who needed to build their forces up. And we see today that we're coming back around to that. I think that the cuts from the forequarter are simply less easy to cook, and so that's why today they're taken less into consideration.
The broth, I've heard that you're going to be turning it into, is this possible, ramen?
Chianti ramen.
Indeed, we are going to be making Chianti ramen.
So this, I mean, fills me with delight on so many levels. You have these two noodle cultures coming together.
Certo.
You're absolutely right. And it also is showing that you can look at meat from a different direction that is not concentrating on a fillet. Meat is incredible food. It's an incredible gift that the animal gives to us. The idea of making Chianti ramen is a perfect plan for using those parts in a simple recipe.
Will this new place also be in Panzano?
È a Panzano.
Actually, the village people are entertained by my numerous projects. All of these little old ladies who were my mother's friends as I was growing up, they say, Dario, don't you ever just want to stop? They used to say it to me when I was a kid, and they say it to me still now.
Do the people who come to the butcher shop, the restaurants that you have now, and will come to Cecchini Panini, so funny, are they primarily inhabitants of Panzano, or do people come from everywhere?
People from town come, but luckily for us, people come from all over the place. There's only about 900 people living in our village, so locals come because my prices are absolutely accessible. A meal at Cecchini Panini will cost 10, maybe 15 euros, so 10, maybe $15.
Tell me a little bit about the space. I hear that it's quite interesting and unusual.
The spaces we're renovating are, in fact, the most historical locations in our small town. One part is a great hall that is about 1,000 years old. It's a hall that is found under the castle of Panzano. It was the armory room. It's a room that has seen war, but in the 1800s and for half of the 1900s, it was actually the elementary school of town. All of the families in town had their children go through that school, and I think that having all those children pass through this room gave it an incredibly positive energy. In fact, I'm also creating a beautiful piazza in front of the building just for kids. And my plan is that every Sunday afternoon will be the most wonderful thing that kids could hope for on a Sunday. I'm going to have a cotton candy machine. And I'm going to give away cotton candy all Sunday afternoon because I think that a community like mine deserves a gift.
Is it difficult in a small town like yours to get permission to make this kind of use of a space that has so much history?
There should be strict laws governing how to renovate historical spaces. As we have moved through the restoration, we found things. We found an incredible medieval arch. We found incredible medieval terracotta floors. And it's correct that somebody is watching over our renovations. Tuscany is beautiful, and it has stayed beautiful because there have always been strict rules about what you can and cannot do. It's not exactly difficult to renovate a building like that. It just takes a good long time. It's actually really exciting because, for instance, 3 weeks ago, as we were digging and clearing, we found this incredible medieval terracotta floor. It's like Indiana Jones. We found this incredible terracotta floor that was probably once the ground that the piazza was built on. Digging deeper, we found a water cistern. So it's very exciting.
You know, when I listen to your new concept and this idea of wanting to use parts of the animal that are normally less celebrated so that you can produce a product that is accessible to more people. I think about our local chefs here in California, Roy Choi and Daniel Patterson, and their fast casual restaurant Local. Is Cecchini Panini sort of your response to fast food?
Yes, absolutely. As I have had the good luck to travel, I've been inspired by lots of butchers that I find and chefs that I find. I perfectly can remember the presentation that I heard Roy Choi give before he had his partner, Daniel. It was a few years ago. We were in Copenhagen at the MAD symposium. In fact, I think maybe the two of them met that year. And I absolutely remember that Roy Choi said something that was perfect. He was there with his family, and he told the story of his life. And he said, I feel a deep responsibility for the people from my neighborhood. I can't use ingredients that are expensive. I need to make good food at a good price that anyone can afford. And that's my same inspiration, exactly the same.
Well, I can't wait to come to Panzano and have a bowl of Chianti ramen.
Anch'io. Ti aspettiamo a braccia aperte.
We're waiting for you with open arms.
The next project for Dario Cecchini and his wife Kim Wicks is Cecchini Panini and Chianti ramen, but not till next March, so you've got plenty of time to get your appetite up. Paradise. That's the way Dario Cecchini described his first bite of steak. Our next guest, Richard Turner, also knows a thing or two about meat. He owns the rare breed meat merchant Turner & George in London, and he wrote a cookbook all about beef called Prime. What kind of cows should we be eating? And further, how can breeds inform flavor?
Different breeds have got different flavors. Obviously, the feed of the animal imparts a certain sort of flavor to it. So I sort of feel strongly we should be eating grass-fed beef. That's more natural. It's got a more natural flavour and it's better for you. I've got my own favourite breeds, but a purebred animal takes longer to reach maturity, and time is where you get flavour from. When you cross breeds, you get something called heterosis, which is like a hybrid vigour, and that makes them grow faster, but they don't develop flavour. So purebred animals taste better.
It's fascinating as someone who's here in the U.S. to go on the butcher shop website and just read through all the different breeds. It kind of makes one want to get on a plane to London to know how it's different. You're known for your Galician steak. What makes it special?
The Galician is a story about the animals, the age of them, because they've grown for much longer than most animals in the beef industry. They're often grown up to 12 years old, 10 to 12 years old. And that's what beef used to be. You know, nowadays we slaughter at like 18 to 30 months, and that's very, very young. So Galician beef is much older, much more beefy. It's very flavourful. It's grown in the Galician mountains, so hills. There's lots of green grass. Grass makes flavour.
What is your preferred way to cook a steak? Can we talk about your butter-fried steak?
Yeah. That's not my preferred way, but that's one method. There's a restaurant here in London called the Gavroche. Years ago in the early 90s, late 80s, we used to cook steaks in butter that way. And we'd use like a pack of butter on each steak, deep fry them, and you get a lovely buttery flavour. And then we'd rest the steaks in the butter and it just soaked up the juices. It's quite decadent, but use good butter. It's not too bad for you.
You would actually pan, sort of braise the steak in butter, constantly basting it.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a well-known technique, but most chefs don't cook steak in butter that way. They'll do a bit of fish that way, maybe. But yeah, you seal it off, quite hot pan, and then you add half the pack, let it foam up over the top of it, basting as you're going, turn it over, add the other half the pack, carry on basting.
I just love it because for a home cook, it's a way of making something unbelievably special and not having to deal with the grill, which I suspect is going to be your favorite method.
Yeah, I'm a live fire cook, so I like charcoal and grills. I like the energy you get from them. I like playing around. I like the whole man fire meat thing.
But if we have this really beautifully sourced piece of meat that we don't want to incinerate, how can we sort of relieve ourselves of the worry that that's going to happen?
Well, if you cook it over charcoal, you need to allow the charcoal or the wood to burn down to a smolder. I think most people cook things too hot, particularly beef. I like to cook at a much lower temperature and you won't get a burn. You'll get like a lovely caramelization of blood sugars called Maillard on the outside of the steak. So lower temperature, so allow the charcoal to burn down, allow the wood to burn down.
Do you subscribe to the technique where rather than just turning it once, you're sort of constantly turning the meat?
Absolutely. I'm not sure where the once thing came from, but it's incorrect. You should be moving the meat around as much as possible. Changing the surface area on the meat. If you've got bars, then the more you move it, the more the surface area goes in contact with the bars. You get more Maillard, and more Maillard means more caramelization of blood sugars, more flavour.
So we're kind of obsessed with pie here. What makes for a really great meat pie?
We have a crust here called a suet crust pastry. I'm not sure if you have it there, but it's suet, flour and water. And suet is from the kidneys, it's the fat around the kidneys. That makes a really good pie because it soaks up the gravy and you get like a crispy top and a sort of gooey, sort of puddingy bottom. And that's my kind of pie. But good gravy is the secret to any good pie.
Is suet from the kidneys of a steer?
Yeah.
So it's sort of the beef equivalent of leaf lard.
Yeah, well, leaf lard is from the pig, the belly of the pig, right? But suet is the fat from around the outside of the kidneys, yeah.
You say that much about what we know and what we depend on about checking for meat quality is wrong. What should we be looking for?
I mean, you should talk to the butcher you're using and find out where the animal comes from, what it was fed, how old it was at slaughter, what kind of animal it was, whether it had a good life. It's very hard to tell just by looking. You should be looking for a nice, well-hung, dark piece of meat, not wet. It should be dry, and it should be firm to the touch.
Because, we have this system here that goes from select through choice into prime, and some people think that that's the only criteria they need.
Yeah, that's, without getting into too much detail, that is false, and it's not true. What they're looking for is marbling and of fat, and they walk around a whole load of prime beef and they grade it according to the marbling they're seeing. But marbling isn't an indicator of good beef. It's often an indicator of intensively farmed beef. A fast-growing animal will put on fat in veins. A slow-growing animal will put on fat in much finer lines that you can't see with the naked eye. So I totally disagree with that method of grading beef. It's for grain-fed animals, not for grass-fed.
Can you speak a bit to the scare tactics you feel are used to keep people from eating meat?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of agree to some extent that you shouldn't be eating meat every day. I mean, America consumes a lot of meat. So do the British. We love our meat. But I kind of agree. I mean, you should really only eat meat sort of once or twice a week. I mean, everything in moderation. But our bodies aren't designed to sort of consume that quantity of protein and energy in big hits. So I kind of agree with it. But you shouldn't scare people into it. It's just, you know, eat less meat, eat more vegetables. It's common sense.
Richard Turner's new beef cookbook is Prime. So have you ever used it?
No, I have not, but I have tasted too many things that probably have it in them, notably in the McDonald's McRib.
Oh, yeah, there's that. There is that.
Yeah, there's Lay's barbecue chips, there's beef jerky. I mean, the list is actually endless.
That's food writer Matthew Sadaka talking about some of the foods he's eaten that make use of liquid smoke. Who developed liquid smoke?
So liquid smoke was developed in 1895 by a pharmacist named Ernest H. Wright. He was based in Kansas City, Missouri, and he actually originally developed it as a preservative. In the South, smokehouses would often have to deal with flies or all sorts of bugs that would get in and ruin their pork belly or their ham. So Wright developed this as a cheap and very quick and efficient method for farmers to cure their meats.
How is it made? Is it made the same as back in 1898?
It's a little bit different now. Nowadays, it's made in a way very similar to distilling whiskey. The hot smoke goes through a condenser. When the hot smoke hits the cold air, it condenses into a liquid. And for the most part, liquid smoke is able to filter out a bunch of the tar, ash. And so what you're left with is just a liquid form of the smoke minus actually a few of the carcinogenic components that you actually wouldn't want.
I think very few people have really understood over the years that it actually is liquid smoke.
Mm-hmm. Most of the brands, at least, that use liquid smoke do add some other stuff to it, like salt, they'll add vinegar. Some of them I've heard have added like soy sauce. I mean, it just depends on which brand you're buying it, but Wright's brand still does have a version that is just liquefied smoke.
It's a fascinating thing. So what are some of the common errors, or what were some of the common errors made by those using it?
The biggest thing is that some people just use way too much of it. I mean, you probably need like 2, maybe 3 dashes of it, and that's enough to kind of get some of the flavor. Of course, it depends on the recipe, but a big thing is like if you have too much of it, it's going to get that sort of acrid, over-smoked taste, and that's how a lot of people ruin their meat.
You also spoke with a few culinary figures who are completely unapologetic about using it. Mm-hmm. What did they have to say?
So the big one that I spoke with was Kenji Lopez-Ald, the brains behind the food lab at Serious Eats. And he said that, again, if you just use minimal amounts, it can make a flavor that's very close to, or even almost identical, to the low and slow method of barbecue. And then there was also Steve Reichlin, who is a very well-known figure in the barbecue world. He's not opposed to putting liquid smoke in your barbecue sauce, which is very commonplace to find liquid smoke. He said, do not put that on your barbecue at all. Don't put it in your meat.
Find a link to the article Matthew Sadaka wrote for Eater about liquid smoke on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. In a minute, we hear about the cutest panda dumplings from our favorite food critic. Don't turn that dial.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW.
If you have heard nothing else about Chengdu impression, you have heard about the panda dumpling.
That's LA Times food writer Jonathan Gold. He's eating those panda dumplings at Chengdu Impression in Arcadia.
It's a rice dumpling served in a broth that's, let's face it, hot water with a leaf in it. Inside the dumpling is a sweet paste. There are little drops of sesame on the surface of the dumpling that make it look like a panda head.
It's the cutest dumpling ever.
It is such a cute dumpling. If you've gone to this place and you haven't Instagrammed the dumpling, you haven't been to this place.
So once we get past the dumpling cuteness, what are we ordering?
The thing that they do that nobody else in town does is a tasting menu.
How many courses are there?
There's usually about 8 or 9. It's $45 a person, which is
insanely reasonable.
Yeah. The food isn't as in-your-face spicy as it would be at Chengdu Taste. It's imaginative in a very different way than Sichuan Impression. But it's worth trying, I think. There'll be a bun stuffed with spiced beef. There'll be a wrap with impossibly fine threads of chicken and crunchy vegetable with a couple of drops of Sichuan peppercorn infused oil. Obviously, a lot of Chinese chefs have incredible technique, but the idea that you can get something that thin and that even using a cleaver is almost like magic, right?
It is magic. I mean, it's high technique.
There will be a beef brisket soup, which may be the single least spicy thing you've ever eaten in a Sichuan restaurant. For some reason, it brings out the flavor of the radish beautifully. Probably the most famous dish there that is not a dumpling shaped like a panda is a cube of braised pork belly that almost quivers. It's so soft. And there's swirl of sauce that looked like something you get at Providence more than something you get at most Chinese restaurants. There's a lovely small bowl of, I guess it's usually called water-boiled fish. Usually you get it in these insanely large truck tire cauldrons.
I love it. It's like my favorite thing.
This is an individual size, which means you don't have a giant catfish glaring out at you, but it's really nice. Do they have the best-known Sichuan dish of all? Kung Pao shrimp. Three of them. 1, 2, 3. There's a lovely thickened stock made with pork and I think some chicken. There's sliced mushrooms in it. And the mushrooms poached nicely. At the end, there is Sichuan wontons, those ones with, you know, floppy, super thin skin, and a forced meat that's more delicate than it usually is. It's probably hand-minced or tastes as if it's hand-minced. It's a dumpling that almost dissolves. It's lovely.
Does the entire table have to order the tasting menu?
Theoretically, the entire table has to order the tasting menu. If you have children, they make exceptions.
That's Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Chengdu Impression in Arcadia. Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations.
It's something that I had been struggling with, well, since the late 80s and didn't know a lot about gluten intolerance and celiac disease. I guess I'm what they would now more precisely term gluten sensitive.
That's Elizabeth Pruitt. She and her husband, Chad Robertson, opened Tartine Bakery in San Francisco a decade ago.
Once I sort of wrapped my head around both the fact that I had to get serious about my health and stop eating and baking with wheat flour, and embracing all the non-wheat flours, that opened me up to being able to be more creative and seeing the possibilities in texture and flavor and not just mimicking what wheat could do.
Pruitt has tips for baking with different grains in her new cookbook. It's called Tartine All Day.
That was part of the fun of putting this new book together, was taking this angle of not necessarily as a gluten-free cookbook per se, although, as you said, everything in it happens to be gluten-free, but really looking at it as an opportunity to discover new things that I hadn't worked with before.
Give me an example of something that you developed that hit the tartine bar and was folded into inventory.
One thing that I
had used a little bit in the past, but not a lot, was teff flour. It's actually made from a very, very tiny seed. It's nutritionally significant. It looks like about half the size of a sesame seed, and it has a very nice quality of holding liquid, a lot of moisture. And it has a little bit more of a pronounced flavor than, say, like rice flour or any of the starches that we bake with. I decided to make a carrot cake with that, and the result was fantastic. You could make it in like a tiny little, like a mini muffin form or a mini madeleine form, and it would still be deliciously crusty on the outside, but very moist. And you can't say that about all of the gluten-free flours. They don't all have that quality.
Let's talk a bit about breakfast. I noticed that one of the items that you have in the book is a granola bark, which I've never seen before. And I thought, wow, that's so smart.
Evan, I think bark is the future of granola.
That's a big statement.
It is. I'm putting it out there right now. When I was doing sort of an informal survey amongst family and friends of what do they like in granola, everybody likes clumpy granola.
Yes.
You want to be able to pick it up. Like you want those big chunks. And I think what people don't realize until they actually make a batch is that you're making those chunks with a lot of sugar and oil. And it's sort of one of those shocking things like restaurant mashed potatoes that you don't actually realize how rich it is until somebody hands you an actual recipe from the restaurant. And this is the deal with granola. You're just really having a cookie for breakfast. So there are a few ways around that. There's a nice way of making granola with like applesauce that helps it clump instead of using a lot of sugar, or in this case with the bark, where I'm actually standing on the sheet tray, pressing it together, and then baking it. There's actually another sheet tray between my shoes and the granola. And so that gives you just like this nice, crispy, chunky granola bar, essentially, without as much sugar as you normally would have.
I love that image. So it's no secret that I really love pie. And when I think about pie, actually, one of the things I love the most about pie are apples, cooked apples. Mm. And the recipe that you have for apple beehive is so beautiful and easy. Could you kind of talk us through it?
Yes, I love that. I love the simplicity of this. So it's called beehive because it looks like an old-fashioned beehive that's made out of straw in a dome. And you're taking advantage of the natural pectin in apples to hold this whole thing together. So you're peeling, slicing, and coring the apple, and you're slicing it in rings horizontally. And you're simply placing them on a baking sheet in concentric circles with a little bit of sprinkled sugar in between the layers and a little bit of butter here and there. You're just slicing and stacking until it's about, I'd say, 5 or 6 inches high or something. And the whole thing gets baked for a long time at a low temperature. And it just coalesces into this lovely, you can still see the layers, but it holds together when you slice it. And so it gets a lovely sort of tinge of burn around the outsides, if that's what you like. And then I glaze the whole thing, and it just is this beautiful apple dome.
We Angelenos get to look forward to your latest venture, which is opening this year. How similar will the menu be to your San Francisco places? Will it be modified for a Southern California audience? And what would that be?
Well, what we're working on right now is exactly what is that core menu of tartine. When we opened Manufactory here in San Francisco, we thought, well, let's make something a little different because we're just down the street from the bakery. And as it turns out, we really didn't need to do that. We could have made every single thing that was the same. And a lot of people expected that. And so you think, well, people might want to try something different, but I guess people have their favorites, and so do we. So we're concentrating on all of our laminated things, our croissants, morning bun, pain au jambon, and creating a system where we can still make all of those by hand, but in a bigger quantity. And that's the trick when you're trying to expand your business to whether it's the same city or a different city. So same thing in LA. We're going to open two places, one in downtown LA and the other in the Row, which is close to downtown. So you'll see the breakfast pastries, very similar. Lunch and dinner will be a similar format. We're working with Chris Bianco, who owns Bianco Pizzeria, and Phoenix, Arizona, and he'll have a restaurant there. And you'll see the same feeling.
Elizabeth Pruitt's new cookbook is Tartine All Day. Look for Tartine Manufacturing in downtown L.A. later this year. We close out the show at the Santa Monica Farmers Market with a prickly fellow. We'll leave it at that. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Let's hear what Laura Avery's getting so tickled about at the market this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. Right now, I'm happy to be talking with Michael Beckman, who is chef owner of Workshop and Truss and Twine in Palm Springs. He's come all the way over from Palm Springs to shop here at the Wednesday Market. And you're featuring a relatively underappreciated ingredient. Tell us what you're shopping for, would you, Michael?
We're picking up some fresh cactus today, otherwise known as nopales.
Okay, so the farmers, we'll talk to a farmer about it later, but it seems like everywhere I go, you see these things hanging over fences. They seem to grow everywhere.
They do. I think they're underappreciated, but I look to, Mexican food was my first inspiration and experience cooking with them. The trick to it is you have to blanch it or fry it after you slice it to get rid of the sliminess. That's the big factor that can be displeasing to somebody approaching it for the first time.
Does a nopales in and of itself impart the flavor, or does it pick up the flavor?
It has a very warm, gentle, earthy flavor on its own that pairs well with subtle spices or chili. I like to feature it in a confit as like sort of a side to go along with cheeses. And we pair that with star anise and cinnamon, orange peel, lemon peels, and raw sugar.
Oh, so yeah, because normally I think what most people associate it with is sort of a stir fry in a taco or a burrito or something with a salsa.
I think one of the most classic ways to eat it is a salad of nopales with scrambled eggs, or just on its own is really beautiful with fresh tomatoes, extra virgin olive oil, fresh garlic. It's really good.
And what about the fruit that grows on top? Is that ever something then you go back out and get?
Those are great as well. They don't have much flavor. They have a beautiful color. So we use them in cocktails or to feature them in a sorbet or vinaigrette, looking for a pop of color, but the flavor is actually very neutral.
So when you're processing the nopales from the spiky, paddle that you get, so you scrape off the spines, peel it, then cook it?
These ones you're just going to need to use a meat fork and a pair of fish tweezers and take off the little spikes. Some of them, when they're bigger and thicker and the skin gets tougher, I peel them. But these types that are thinner and more tender, you don't need to peel them. Just get the thorns out.
So I've never heard of a confit with the cactus paddle. So tell us all about that.
So Truss and Twine, we really look to the desert as a source of inspiration for the food to evoke a sense of place. And one of our quintessential desert dishes is a local goat cheese whipped with local honey, rolled in dehydrated bougainvillea dust, and featured with the nopales confit, which has those warm spice tones of the star anise and the citrus and the cinnamon. And it goes well along with most cheese assortments, but I really like it in this particular setup with honey and goat cheese.
Explain briefly how you make the confit.
The confit, so you take the first step as usual, slice them thin, blanch them and shock them. And then you make a syrup with the sugar and steep your spices in there and your citrus peels. And then you add the blanched nopales in there and cook it down, like stew it down for 30, 40 minutes in a rondo and just wait for it to be really well cooked and flavorful. Chill it, let it rest overnight, and it's really beautiful. Holds well for a few weeks.
So you're basically cooking it down to kind of a thick syrupy. Does it remain syrupy or does it kind of solidify?
You want it to be a little spreadable. Like think about serving it on toast. Soft and then juicy as well, so it retains some of the braising liquid, the syrup.
Can you tell us a little bit about the bougainvillea flower?
Absolutely. That's a really exciting element. If you pick it raw, it leaves a little bit of a numbing effect on your tongue, but we've discovered that tossed in a salad with the oil and vinegar, even just tearing little petals in like two or three pieces, have a really beautiful, bright tone. And mixed in with other seasonings, it's a nice flavor profile. It's not necessarily something you want to eat a whole mouthful of bougainvillea on your own. But when you dehydrate it, it takes on these wonderful tea-like tones. And we work in Herbes de Provence with it just to give it a little more herbal backbone. And we just put that in a dehydrator and roll the goat cheese with the honey in it. It's really beautiful.
That was Michael Beckman. He is chef owner of Workshop and Truss and Twine restaurants out in Palm Springs and inspiring us for things that are grown and appreciated out in the desert. Mario Trevino, Trevino Farm, is a farmer from Lompoc, and he's one of the farmers here who grows nopales and has been growing them for years. Mario, do you plant them or were they wild?
They're planted.
And where do you get the seed? Or how do you start them?
The little leaves we sell, they get to like about 12 inches. And once they mature, you cut it off, put it in the ground, it'll start shooting roots.
When you cut that big leaf off and stick it in the ground, how long does it take till it forms the little edible leaves?
A couple of years.
Okay, and how do you know if it's taken? You just stick it in the ground and then it just
water? Well, if it doesn't take, it'll die. Some of them won't take, but most of them will take.
Do you plant them like in, what kind of soil do they like?
It doesn't make any difference.
So you can stick that in the ground anywhere?
Yes.
Yeah.
And they'll take off.
How big is your biggest cactus plant?
I would say it's like about 10 feet tall.
And that's the one that's how many years old?
It's about 24 years old.
And they will just live forever. They just keep sending out new leaves.
Mm-hmm. And they keep growing all year. In the spring, they do the tender leaves. And in the fall, they do the tunas.
What is a tunas?
The fruit.
And that's called a cactus pear?
Cactus pears.
How do you eat the cactus pear apple?
Well, the best way that I know they prepare them is they skin them, they put them in the blender, and they add a little bit of water, mix it up, and make water out of it.
Like agua fresca?
Agua fresca.
Something like that? Yeah. And Maria at your booth was telling us that people like to juice the nopales cactus leaf, and it's good for diabetes?
And arthritis.
Okay. Do you know anyone who's actually had that and had it work?
Well, I guess you could say me, because I had a bad knee that I wanted to put a pin on it a few years ago, but I wouldn't let him, and I've been in cactus ever since.
Okay, so the nopales, it's in season now. It'll be all through the summer. You'll have little leaves all through summer.
No, I think in about maybe 6 more weeks it'll stop.
Because it gets too big?
No, it gets too hot for it.
Okay, stops producing.
Then it starts making the fruit.
I see. Okay, so this is a perfect time of year to get it. Mm-hmm. All right. And you're at the Wednesday Santa Monica, Virginia Avenue Park Santa Monica. Where else do you go?
Studio City Sunday.
Studio City Sunday. That's where we can find this nopales.
I don't think I'm down there because nobody bought them over there.
Oh.
Just market and Saturday market.
Okay, Santa Monica, Wednesday, Saturday. Okay. All right, good. That was Mario Trevino. He and his family farm in Lompoc, and he grows this wonderful nopales. He's also the only guy who has the rhubarb. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
That's it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can listen to the show on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also download our show wherever you get your podcasts. As always, many thanks to the Good Food team. Here they are.
Abby Fentress-Swanson.
Laurel Garcia.
Joseph Stone.
Hey, Abby, here's mine.
Camellia Say.
Joel Stein.
And Ronnie Mickelson.
And I'm Evan Kleiman. I'll be back next week with more Good Food.